Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. One of the most terrifying things in the world for young African-American men is knowing that certain people can feel threatened by you, simply by existing. Black blindness is a phenomenon that makes white cops see an imaginary gun on an African-American man during a routine traffic stop. Sometimes it can go hand in hand with the Stand Your Ground law. In 2012, the Tampa Bay Times found that those who killed African-Americans using the law went free 73% of the time, while those who killed white people using the law went free 59% of the time. This controversial law offers protection to people who harm or kill somebody who they feel threatened by. The ambiguity of the definition of threat under this law grants so much latitude that the law can often be abused. The Stand Your Ground law sets the bar incredibly low for what constitutes as a threat, and when deadly force can be used to neutralize that so-called threat, it makes for a slippery slope. In 2012, much of America was celebrating the re-election of the nation's first African-American president. But just 3 weeks later, in Jacksonville, Florida, the murder of an unarmed African-American teenager was a bloody reminder of just how far we still have to go in the battle against racism. It was a pleasant evening in Jacksonville, Florida, on the 23rd of November, 2012, when 17-year-old Jordan Davis and three of his friends, Leland Brunson, Tommy Storns, and Tevin Thompson, pulled into the forecourt of Gate Petroleum gas station at around 7:40 p.m. Jordan Davis was a 17-year-old African-American student at Wolfson High School who was just about to start his new job at McDonald's.
Jordan used to say, "Oh, you name me after Michael Jordan." And, you know, and I would laugh about that, but that wasn't it. No. I mean, we had decided that if we had a girl, he would choose the name. If we had a boy, I would choose the name. And I never told you because I already knew we had a boy anyway. So I knew I was going to get to choose
the name. Stack deck. That's how it
is. I knew I was going to get to choose the name. But anyway, I chose Jordan because for me, it symbolized the crossing over of the Jordan River in the Bible. I wanted to name him something that would symbolize a crossing over and a new beginning.
Jordan dreamed of joining the Marine Corps. He went to church weekly and had a deep passion for music, spending a lot of his time mixing. In school, he made friends easily and was always complimented on his smile and his expensive sneakers. Quote, "He was a cool cat. He was goofy all the time. He had a good sense of humor," end quote, said his friend Lloyd Haynes.
I remember the first day I met him and he introduced me. He's like, "Tevin, this is Jordan. Jordan, this is Tevin." He's like, "For a big boy, I swear you smooth." That was the first day I met him. Usually when somebody called me big, I'd be like, "Dang, that's kind of green." But he made me happy. I was just like, "Oh, thank you, bruh."
People portray us as gang members and bad kids. If they hung out with us today, they would have known who the real people were.
We lived in the suburbs. The struggle is not about, you know, it's eight of y'all in one bedroom house, your mom's a crackhead, your dad left you when you was 2 years old. That's beyond struggle. We're talking about the everyday struggle, you know? What teenagers go through, no gas money, so you can't get picked up.
No money, period, as a teenager, is just awful.
Facebook, Instagram dry, so you can't talk to no females.
Yep.
That's the struggle. He's the dressed nice, so I mean right. By the best basketball best shoes, elite socks.
Have a snapback to match.
Oh my. He'll come on the court, I'll be like, "Man, he look amazing. He looks like he's gonna dunk on everybody." And then he gets the ball and he'd start dribbling. I was like, "Okay, maybe he's just joking around." And then he shoots the ball. He's the worst player that you ever will see. Like, ever.
but it never stopped him from wanting to play.
Jordan's parents divorced when he was 3 years old, but the separation was amicable and Jordan remained close with both of them. He enjoyed roller skating with his mother, Lucia, in Atlanta, and swimming with his father, Ron, on Jacksonville Beach. Jordan and his father, who he lived with in Jacksonville, had recently purchased golf clubs and planned on taking up a new hobby together.
Yeah, he was athletic. He liked sports. He played a little baseball.
Humorous. Fun-loving. Jokester. Full of a lot of understanding and wisdom. Jordan was raised most definitely on a strong spiritual foundation. And we had him in private Christian school for a few years until fourth grade, then pulled him out and I homeschooled him from fourth grade to eighth grade.
The couple had struggled to get pregnant, so when Jordan came along, he was their little miracle. Next, we will hear from Brunson, Thompson, and Ron chatting about Jordan.
We used to go to the court every day. I'm talking about every, and it's just crazy how he never got better.
You thought, could he play defense? Could he play a little defense?
I mean, yeah, because he was hyper, and he, he could jump, you know what I'm saying? He had the athletic ability, and like, you getting tired, but there's no way Jordan gonna stop. But then when he gets the ball,
oh, that's when.
That's when you can just take it real quick. You can take it right back.
Yeah, I used to tell myself, man, you know, you got to practice with the old man before you get out here with your boys, you know. The old man can give you some pointers, you know.
And Jordan, I mean, he should have played football. I think that's
that was his best sport.
Yeah, I think he could have been real good at football.
Y'all didn't play baseball together?
No,
we didn't. He was good baseball. He could play baseball.
We never really ventured out into other sports.
He was real fast around the bases and all that. Could hit.
See, I think that was the problem when it came to basketball. Mm-hmm. He ran too fast.
At the speed.
And the ball wasn't moving.
Right, as he was moving, yeah.
The group of teenage boys had spent the late afternoon taking advantage of the Black Friday sales and, as they said, shopping for girls. And now they wanted to stop at the shop to get some cigarettes and gum. After parking their SUV in the forecourt, Storms left the engine running while he went into the gas station, leaving his three friends in the car with their music blaring and the windows rolled down. Moments later, 45-year-old Michael Dunn, a white software developer, pulled into the forecourt with his fiancée, Rhonda Ruhr. Dunn was from Brevard County but had been in Jacksonville for his 23-year-old son's wedding. Dunn and his son had been distant for a number of years, but the plan was that they were going to start rebuilding their lost relationship. Dunn and Ruhr had left the wedding in Orange Park early that evening because they needed to get back to their hotel room to tend to their 6.5-week-old puppy, Charlie. Dunn pulled his car up alongside the SUV of teenagers, and Ruhr entered the gas station to purchase a bottle of wine. As the three teenagers sat in the SUV waiting for Storms to return, they were listening to their music pretty loudly. Dunn was parked beside the teenagers, waiting for Ruhr to return with the wine. As he sat in the car, he apparently became agitated with the teenagers' loud music. He told the teenagers to turn the music down, to which they complied. However, moments later, Jordan turned the music back up. It all went downhill from here. Dunn reached down into his car, retrieving his 9mm from the glove box, and came up firing. He peppered the teenager's SUV with 10 bullets, the final four of which hit the car after Dunn stepped out of his own car and shot towards the SUV as the teenagers attempted to drive away from the danger. Three of those bullets hit Jordan, who was sitting in the back seat. Two of the bullets hit Jordan in the leg and one went through his side, hitting his liver and lungs. Jordan died in the back seat, in his best friend's arms. As the shots echoed out in the forecourt, Don's fiancée ran outside and asked Don what had happened. Quote, "I just fired at these kids," end quote, he said, before they sped away from the scene, driving at 159 miles per hour and returned to their hotel room. While Jordan was laying in the hospital mortuary, Don was ordering himself a pizza and making a cocktail. Jordan's parents recollect finding out that Jordan had been shot and seeing his body.
We were here for Thanksgiving, and everybody was in a really good mood, just relaxing and having a real holiday. And I just talked to Jordan Thanksgiving Day. And then the day after, my phone was sitting on top of the dresser, and I just came in and I saw it was Ron. It was about 10:45, and I said, "Hey, Ron, how you doing? What's up? Happy Thanksgiving." He said, "I got something I need to tell you." And I said, "Where is Jordan? What happened to Jordan?" And he didn't want to tell me, and I yelled. I said, "What happened to Jordan?"
So when I get to the hospital, and there was Jordan sleeping, he appeared to be sleeping. And one of his eyes was halfway open, like he could see me. And as I went over to hug him, one of the aides said, "Because it's an investigation, you can't touch the body." And I ignored him. And I went on and I hugged my son and I kissed him. And I started talking to him. And I told him it was going to be all right.
That you were supposed to protect me.
Yeah.
You were supposed to protect me.
And I said, "I know." I said, "But I couldn't." I said, "You know, something happened that was so unusual in his nature. There's no way anybody could protect him. What happened, it wasn't like he was in a bad neighborhood. He was 5 minutes from home. He wasn't late at night at 7:40 in the evening. He was with his good friends, all good boys."
At some point, after he was drawing his last breaths, he probably thought about what Dad was saying to him. "Watch what you say. Take care of yourself. Because there are people out here that will do things that they should not do." And I could just see him in my heart just apologizing to me, knowing that it's going to hurt me to the rest of my days on this earth. That's what pains me.
On the Saturday, Michael Dunn was arrested at his Brevard County home, which was around 170 miles away from Jacksonville. He had been tracked down via his license plate tag, which several witnesses had written down as he sped away from the crime scene. He told the detectives who arrested him that he was just about to hand himself in to his neighbour who was in law enforcement. He was booked into the Brevard County Jail, where he pleaded not guilty to the charges of murder and attempted murder. Several days later, he was extradited to Jacksonville. Following Don's arrest, he readily confessed to the shooting. However, he claimed that he had felt threatened by the teenagers and feared that his life was in danger. According to Don, the murder was self-defense.
"What's going on with your life that...
Oh, no, my life is great. Life is great. What, I've got a place on the beach. I got a great job. I got a great girl. Mm-hmm. We just got a little puppy. I mean, the way I see this, this was, I was scared for my life, mm-hmm. and I fought back. Mm-hmm. And you guys are seeing this as murder. Do I need to get a lawyer? I mean, it sounds like I'm in deep shit."
Don's defense attorney, Robin Lemonidis, claimed that Don politely asked the teenagers to turn their music down, and they began to threaten him. However, during the interview with police, Dunn said he couldn't be sure if it was one of the teenagers who said that or whether it was a song being played in the car. According to Dunn, he then saw Jordan reach for a shotgun and begin to open the door as if he was advancing on him. Dunn said that when he saw the shotgun, he reached for his own gun and opened fire. His defense lawyer added that Dunn saw, quote, at least four black men in the SUV, and he doesn't know how old anybody is, but he knows a shotgun when he sees one, end quote. According to his lawyer, Dunn acted as any responsible firearms owner would have. However, there was no gun found anywhere in the teenager's vehicle or the surrounding area.
So just kind of walk me through, you know, just tell me from your point of view what happened at that point.
The guy that was in the back is getting really agitated. You know, there was a lot of fuck him and fuck that and fuck that bitch. And then the music comes back on. I don't know if they're singing or what, but they're saying, kill him. So I put my window down again, and I said, excuse me, are you talking about me? You know, I'm still not reacting, but then this guy, like, goes down on the ground and comes up with something. I thought it was a shotgun. And he goes, you're dead, bitch, and he opens his door. Mm-hmm. And I'm shitting bricks. But that's when I reached in my glove box, mm-hmm. unholstered my pistol, and I shot.
I'll be the first to tell you there's no weapons in that car. I don't know what you saw.
That's the possible, and they drove off. They dumped it.
They never left the parking lot.
Yeah, they drove out, circled right back around, and came right back to that spot.
Oh, okay, because...
If there was a shotgun, a BB gun, any type of gun at the scene... Hell, if it was a water gun that was black, that looked real at the scene...
Like I said, it was a barrel. Could have been just a stick, but, I mean, it was...
Could it have been your imagination?
It's certain... Well, no. I mean, anything's possible, I guess, but... The him coming out of his car was not my imagination.
Dunn's attorney made the claim that the teenagers could have just thrown the gun away before police arrived. Jacksonville attorney John Phillips, who was representing the Davis family, said that Lemonidis was defamatory and unethical and was trying to build bias on a future jury. While the teenagers did drive away from the scene, they only got around 400 meters away before realizing that Jordan had been hit. They then reversed back to the gas station, returning less than 2 minutes after the shooting occurred. So where exactly could they have hidden the gun if they did in fact have a gun? The entire area was searched, yet no gun was ever retrieved. Dunn claimed that he wasn't aware that he had hit anybody in the car, despite the fact that he had fired 10 times. Many questioned why he fled the scene, but his attorney claimed that he was afraid of how the teenagers may have reacted to him firing into the car, and that he was worried that they may have been gang members, with other members of the gang nearby, ready to retaliate. However, if that were the case, why didn't Dunn flee to somewhere that was safe and then notify police? Instead, Dunn waited until the news the following morning to find out that Jordan had died, and then instead of turning himself in, he fled back to his home. Also consider this. Dunn claimed that Jordan was pointing a gun at him, yet he somehow managed to reach down into his glove box, open it, unholster the gun, and then bring it up to shoot. Who could possibly be that fast on the draw? The murder of Jordan crushed his family's hearts. His father, Ron, spoke to several news outlets. Quote, they were just kids, 17-year-old kids, they have never been in trouble, end quote, he said. He described his son as a well-behaved teenager that wasn't in a gang and didn't even own a gun. Ron also said he would now be missing out on witnessing all of his son's milestones, such as falling in love and getting married. Quote, all the things that I'm not going to be able to do is what pains me, end quote.
When I wake up in the morning, I'm always listening for Jordan for whether he's up or not. And I still have it in my mind that he may be downstairs until I realize after a couple of seconds, mere seconds, that he's not going to be downstairs and that I am in the situation that I'm at a trial for the killer of my son. And sometimes you sit there and you're thinking, and 5 and 6, 7, maybe sometimes 10 minutes will go by, and you find yourself just staring at the ceiling in the morning. And then something just wheels you to get up, say, you know what, you got to make another day. Just get up, put your feet on the floor, stand up, and just make another day, because you got to go on.
Ron said that he did not want revenge because that wouldn't bring his son back. Instead, he just wanted to look Don in the eye and understand why he killed his son. Quote, "A lot of me died with Jordan," end quote, Ron told the Associated Press. A viewing for Jordan was held at a local funeral home in Jacksonville. Hundreds of his schoolmates crowded into the funeral home to pay their final respects. Quote, "He was always smiling. You know, he had a big million-dollar smile. Always smiling, and you know, just seeing him with his mouth closed, it's sad," end quote, said Jordan's friend Maurice Ivory. A funeral service was held on the 30th of November 2012 at the Trinity Chapel Church of God in Powder Springs, and afterwards, Jordan was buried at Kennesaw Memorial Park. In the wake of the shooting, the American News ran an article from Leonard Pitts Jr. on black blindness. They described it as, quote, "a kind of myopia that afflicts some of us, too many of us, whenever we gaze upon a dark-skinned man. It causes some of us, too many of us, to see things that are not there and to miss things that are. Sometimes it is fatal," end quote. They questioned whether Don had black blindness when he shot at the SUV. After all, he did claim he saw a shotgun, despite the fact that no such shotgun was ever retrieved. Many questioned whether Don would use the controversial Stand Your Ground law. The Stand Your Ground law allows people to use force, including deadly force, if a threat is perceived that may lead to injury or death. Just weeks before the shooting, a state task force had deemed that the law was sound and didn't need major legislative reform.
I feel sick in my stomach. I feel sick in my stomach because they're going to argue that he did have a reasonable belief that his life was in danger. He had a reasonable belief because maybe they didn't have a gun, but he thought they had a gun. What do you say?
There's a possibility you can get away with, you know, pulling a trigger, shooting someone, and saying, oops, I'm sorry.
It doesn't have to be a real threat. It has to be a perceived threat.
The self-defense laws were a lot easier for prosecutors when there was a duty to retreat. The change to no duty to retreat and to be able to stand your ground and meet force with force has truly muddied the waters quite a bit.
This is not about politicking. This is not about inflaming racial tensions. This is about the right of everyone to protect themselves, to protect their family.
Florida had seen an influx of stand your ground claims, even in prosecutions with minor injuries. There was a worry that Florida's stand your ground law would become a get out of jail free card for Dunn. The fear reverberated in the African American community and became a sober reminder for the families of every boy that looked like Jordan Davis. If Don had genuinely acted in self-defense and felt that the shooting was justified by the Stand Your Ground law, then why did he flee the scene? Especially when there were eyewitnesses who could corroborate his claims if what he was saying was true. In the immediate aftermath, a lot of people believed that the teenagers were profiled by Don. Quote, "They were in their father's car. They were playing their music loud. He looked at them. See, what people in this country tend to forget is that if you're black, you do certain things in a certain way, you get profiled," end quote, said Pastor R.L. Gundy in an interview with All Things Considered. Even without the overlay of race, Don's story was shaky at best. On the 3rd of December, Don was denied bond. His lawyer announced that he would be using the Stand Your Ground law as a defense. Shortly thereafter, Don was indicted by a grand jury on a charge of first-degree murder and 3 charges of attempted murder. Beforehand, he had been charged with second-degree murder. The state attorney's office said that they would not be seeking the death penalty, and if Don were found guilty, he would be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. With the new charges, Don replaced his lawyer with Florida attorney Corey Strola and pleaded not guilty. The following week, a memorial was held in memory of Jordan. A group of people gathered at Friendship Fountain on the city's south bank. Around 75 people carried candles and spoke openly about Jordan and gun laws. As they gathered at a high spot in the park, Jordan's father said, quote, "Jordan is looking down right now and smiling," end quote. He called for the Stand Your Ground law to be repealed. After the memorial, Jordan's mother, Lucia, announced that she was petitioning the White House online to get the Stand Your Ground law repealed. By March of 2013, new evidence was introduced. The evidence included 6 phone calls to 911 from eyewitnesses at the gas station. It also included pictures that showed the bullet-ridden SUV, a blood-stained sweatshirt, and Jordan's toxicology report, which showed that there was no alcohol or drugs in his system. John Phillips, the attorney representing Jordan's family, said that there was no evidence that Jordan, or anybody else in the SUV, had a weapon that night. Quote, "In order for Don to claim self-defense, there better have been a gun in that car," end quote, he said. According to court reports, when Don's fiancée, Rhonda Ruhr, had asked what happened, Don never actually told her that he had seen a gun. He simply told her that he felt threatened by the teenagers and thought that they were going to advance on him. Following Don's arrest, Ruhr told police that it was pretty common for Don to complain about, quote, "thug music," end quote, but that it was unusual for him to confront anybody over it. Next, we will hear from Tevin Thompson.
Thug is the new N-word. That's the new way they pursuing us now. N-word is out and thug is in. Michael Dunn, he just seen 4 black kids and he heard the music and he just instantly put thug next to 4 black kids. But you know, if 4 white kids was listening to it, you know what I'm saying, what would you think? They don't call Justin Bieber a thug. He raced in Lamborghinis and all this crazy stuff. He's not a thug, he's just a misled kid, you know what I'm saying? So it's just like, thug is just something for African Americans to be called the N-word without being, they don't want to seem wrong for calling us the N-word, so they'd be like, look at those thugs.
The court documents also shed more light into what happened on the forecourt that evening. Apparently when Don told the teenagers to turn their music down, the teenager sitting in the front seat complied. However, Jordan then told his friend to turn the music back up. When the music was turned back up, Don began to argue with Jordan as they both sat in their own vehicles. Jordan's friend said that yeah, Jordan did talk back to Don, but he felt why should he turn the music down? He wasn't hurting anybody and they were only going to be there for another minute. As the argument was getting heated, a witness was leaving the gas station. The witness told investigators that he saw Don pointing a handgun out of his car and shouting, quote, "You're not going to talk to me like that," end quote, before he began firing at the SUV and continuing to fire as the SUV left the parking lot. None of the witnesses to the shooting saw a gun or any other weapon on the teenagers. Ruhr also told police that before the shooting occurred, she and Don had been drinking at the wedding. She said that Don had 3 rum and cokes and she had 1 glass of red wine and 2 rum and cokes. She said that when they got back to the hotel after the shooting, they ordered pizza and then went to bed. Quote, "I don't want it to come across as we weren't upset that Friday night. In my head, I'm thinking, you stupid ass, but he was already upset, so I figured I'd tell him in the morning," end quote, she said. The evidence was damning to Don. Quote, "From the start, this has been a credibility case, and each new piece of information that comes out shows that Michael Don cannot be trusted," end quote, said Phillips. Then in October, the state attorney's office released derisive letters that Don had sent from jail. In these letters, Don called Jordan a thug and used the same term to describe African-American inmates that he was locked up with. He said that he believed that he would get away with the murder as long as the jury was white and the trial is moved to another county that is, quote, predominantly white and Republican, and supports gun rights, end quote. In one letter to his grandmother, he wrote, quote, "The whites who live in Jacksonville know how the blacks behave, and the blacks want to protect their own. And of course, daddy of the thug I had to defend myself against raised an immaculate child who could do no wrong," end quote. In a letter to his fiancée, Don wrote, quote, "I just got off the phone with you and we were talking about how racist the blacks are up here. The more time I am exposed to these people, the more prejudiced against them I become," end quote. And in a letter to his daughter, Don wrote, quote, "This may sound a bit radical, but if more people would arm themselves and kill these fucking idiots when they're threatening you, eventually they may take the hint and change their behavior," end quote. In another letter to WJXXX in Jacksonville, Dunn said, quote, "After multiple threats of death by Jordan Davis and his brandishing of a weapon, I was convinced that my life was in danger. I had no choice but to defend myself. I am not a murderer. I am a survivor," end quote. Shortly thereafter, the bill to repeal the Stand Your Ground law was rejected. Dunn's trial was slated for February of 2014 after Dunn was unsuccessful in getting it postponed. By the 5th of February, the jury was chosen. Out of the 12 jurors, 10 were white. Of course, this led to some fears that they would automatically identify with Dunn. The trial echoed that of George Zimmerman, a Hispanic man who shot and killed Trayvon Martin, an unarmed African-American teenager, in 2012, just 2 hours away from Jacksonville. Zimmerman was acquitted and the case and trial garnered worldwide attention.
Well, me and Jordan had talked about the Trayvon Martin case. I remember Jordan put a hoodie on. He had a brown hoodie. He said, "We kind of look alike, Dad." Trayvon Martin's father texted me a couple of days after it happened. "I just want to welcome you to a club that none of us want to be in."
The trial of Michael Dunn began on the 6th of February. In opening statements, the jury heard from prosecutor John Guy and Dunn's defense attorney, Corey Strola. One of the first witnesses to testify was Stephen Smith. Smith had pulled up to the gas station and went inside to buy a fountain drink.
"When you pulled up, was there an open spot to the right of the red Dodge Durango?"
"Yes, ma'am, there was."
"Tell these jurors why you didn't pull into that empty spot next to the sidewalk."
"I heard the loud music. Didn't want to deal with it."
"Were you aware of anything going on in the parking lot?"
"No, ma'am. You could still hear the music. That was it."
"Okay. And when you approached the clerk, did you say something to the clerk about that music?"
"Yes, ma'am, I did."
"Tell the jurors what you said."
"I asked her, I said, I wish they'd turn that up. It's my favorite song."
When Smith was leaving the gas station, he heard the altercation between Dunn and Jordan.
"Please tell the jurors what happened next."
"I heard someone yell, or someone say something very loud."
"And what did you hear that person say?"
"No, you're not going to talk to me that way." "And I saw a pistol in the front seat between the steering wheel, glove compartment area. It was a big silver chrome, either 9mm or 45. It was a large caliber."
Smith told the courtroom that he witnessed Dunn reaching into the glove compartment for his gun and opening fire at the SUV. Another witness, Sean Lee Atkins, had been sitting in his truck when he heard the shots fired. He looked up and saw the SUV speed out of the parking lot while he saw Dunn crouched behind his open door, firing at the vehicle as the teenagers attempted to escape. Atkins memorized Dunn's license plate number and wrote it down on a paper bag. The store clerk, Maria Grimes, testified that she had been serving Dunn's fiancé in the gas station when the shots were fired. Andrew Williams, who was at the gas station with his wife and a teenage couple they were chaperoning, testified that he had administered CPR on Jordan and that he never saw a gun or weapon inside or around the SUV.
"Did you see any type of weapon in that young man's hand at all?"
"No."
"Did you see any weapons coming out of that vehicle being thrown anywhere?"
"No."
"Did you have a clear view of the driver when he got out of the red vehicle?"
His side, no. I mean, I saw the door open and I saw his head, but I was on the opposite side of the vehicle.
"Did you see him make any throwing gestures towards the bushes near his vehicle?"
"No, ma'am."
Did you hear or see the other occupants of the vehicle at that particular time?
I heard them.
What did you hear?
Upsetness. One of the young men was yelling, "He's not moving."
He's not moving.
Yes,
did you know at that point in time to whom they were referring?
No.
What did you do then?
Walked up to the car to see what was going on.
All right. Did you have any concerns at all that someone inside that car was going to hurt you?
No.
Another witness at the gas station that evening was Samantha Aitches. She said that she pulled in just before the teenagers returned to the forecourt after noticing that Jordan had been shot. She said that the teenagers all looked shocked and asked her to call 911. For 14 months, Jordan's three friends who were with him that night in the SUV remained silent while they mourned the loss of their friend. Now they were going to be key witnesses in the trial of the man who killed him. Tevin Thompson, who was sitting in the front passenger seat, recalled the evening.
Where did the four of you go first
when you and Tommy picked up Leland Brunson and Jordan Davis?
My house, sir.
And why did you go to your house?
To change.
And why did you want to change?
Wanted to go pick up some girls.
Okay. Where did you go after you changed?
Town Center.
At some point while the three of you were waiting for Tommy Storns to come back, did a car pull into the parking space on the passenger side of the Dodge Durango?
Yes, sir.
And is that the side that you were sitting on?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Thompson, while the three of you were waiting for Tommy Storns, did the defendant say anything to you or in your direction?
Yes, sir.
And what was that?
He said, "Can you turn the music down? I can't hear myself think."
And what did you do when he said, "Turn the music down"?
I turned the music down.
When you turned the music down, did either Leland Brunson or Jordan Davis say anything to you?
Yes, sir.
Who spoke?
Jordan.
And what did Jordan Davis say?
Turn the music back up.
Did he curse when he said that?
Yes, sir.
Even if it's curse words, Mr. Thompson, you can repeat what Jordan Davis said.
Fuck that. Turn the music back up.
Thompson said that he and his friends had been listening to their music loudly while they waited for their other friend, Tommy Storns, to make a purchase inside the gas station. He recollected how Don parked so close to them that he couldn't open the door. He said Don then shouted, quote, "Turn your music down, I can't hear myself think," end quote. Thompson complied and turned the volume down, but Jordan then asked him to turn it back up. He said that Jordan and Dunn then began to argue. As the argument was underway, Storns returned to the car and before climbing into the driver's seat, he did a little dance to the music. He said that moments later, Dunn opened fire. By the time Thompson finished testifying, Jordan's mother had tears streaming down her face. Next, Leland Brunson, Jordan's best friend, took to the stand.
Good afternoon, sir. If you'd please tell the members of the jury your name.
My name is Leland Brunson.
Where did you meet Jordan Davis?
At school.
And in the fall of 2012, how often would you see or talk to Jordan Davis?
Almost every day.
Did you see or hear the driver say anything to Jordan Davis after Tommy Storns got back in the Durango?
Yes.
What was that?
Are you talking to me?
And how could you hear that?
Tevin turned the music down.
When?
When Tommy got back in to let him know what happened.
Did Jordan Davis say anything back to the driver when the driver said, "Are you talking to me?"
Yes.
What did he say?
"Yeah, I'm talking to you."
What did you see the driver of the other car do when Jordan Davis said, "Yeah, I'm talking to you"?
He reached into his glove department.
He told the courtroom how he saw Don pull out the handgun from the glove box, pull the slide back, and begin to fire. Brunson said that when he tried to pull Jordan down so that he wouldn't get shot, Jordan just slumped down into his lap.
What did Tommy Storns do when the driver of the other car started firing into Jordan Davis's door?
He put it in reverse and backed up.
Did he back up?
Yes.
Was the defendant still firing when Tommy Storns was backing away?
Yes, sir.
And what happened to Jordan Davis? He stayed sitting up?
No, I tried to pull him down, but when I pulled him down, he just fell into my lap. I called his name, but he didn't respond, so I checked his body to see if he was hit.
How did you check his body?
I just pat him down in his upper body.
Did you touch anything that led you to believe he had been shot?
Yes.
What?
When I reached and touched him, blood appeared on my fingers.
He said he kept shouting Jordan's name, but Jordan never responded. Brunson then began patting Jordan down, trying to see if he had been shot. That was when he noticed that when he touched Jordan, blood appeared on his hands. While crossing Brunson, Strolla suggested in a scolding manner that Brunson was lying because he loved his best friend. Tommy Storns testified that as soon as Dom began to fire, he knew they were in danger, and he immediately started to back out of the forecourt.
Did you hear any gunshots strike the car?
I remember hearing glass shatter.
And how did you feel when you were driving away, being shot at, and you heard the glass shatter?
I mean, I was in a panic. Just scared.
He sniffled as he recollected how he called out each of his friends' names, but Jordan didn't respond. By this point, Jordan was bleeding profusely and gasping for air. All three denied that they had a gun or that they hid a gun. Alyssa LeBlanc, who was leaving the Loop restaurant beside the gas station, testified that she had seen the teenager speed off and saw Storns and Thompson get out of the car to check on Jordan before putting the car in reverse and going back to the gas station forecourt. LeBlanc testified that they didn't take anything out of the car. Strolla said that Jacksonville police did not properly investigate whether the teenagers may have hidden a gun. Detective Musser said that they searched the surrounding area and found no gun. When Strolla suggested that they threw the gun on a roof somewhere, Musser said that the closest building was 40 yards away. Rhonda Ruhr took to the stand on day 2 of the trial. She held closely to a packet of tissues and appeared nervous as she described the day of the shooting.
How long have you known Mr. Dunn for?
About 4 years.
Ms. Rauer, what is your relationship to Mr. Dunn?
He's my fiancé.
Now, Ms. Rauer, I'd like to turn your attention to November 22nd of 2012. Was that Thanksgiving of 2012?
Yes.
Why were you all up in Jacksonville that night?
Because we were going to go to his son's wedding the next day.
Why did you and the defendant come up to Jacksonville on Thursday night for the Friday wedding?
Because we have a puppy named Charlie, and because you usually can't check into hotels until like 3 or 4, and with the wedding being at 4, we didn't think we'd have time to get settled.
What was the reason for stopping at the gas station?
To get a bottle of wine.
And whose idea was it, Ms. Rauer?
Mine.
Did the defendant say anything about the music when he parked the car next to the red car?
Yes.
And what did the defendant say?
Oh, I hate that thug music.
And what was your response to the defendant?
I said, yes, I know.
What happened, Ms. Rauer, after the defendant parked the car?
I gave him a kiss. I took $20 and I went into the store.
She said that they had been drinking at the wedding, but said Don seemed sober enough to drive them to the gas station and then to the hotel.
As you were walking to the register, did you hear anything unusual?
Yes.
What did you hear?
I heard pop, pop, pop.
And when you heard those noises, did you know what they were?
No, I didn't.
Did you know where they were coming from?
No, I didn't.
When she finished testifying, she whispered, quote, "I'm so sorry," end quote, but it was unclear if she was speaking to a bailiff, Dunn, Jordan's family, or someone else. Stacey Simons, former associate medical examiner, testified about the autopsy of Jordan. She presented her findings while showing several photographs of Jordan taken at the morgue. Simon said that Jordan had been shot while sitting in the SUV and while leaning away from Dunn, completely contradicting his defense lawyer's claim that Jordan was advancing on Dunn at the time of the shooting. Dunn decided that he would testify on his own behalf.
Hi, good morning. I'm Michael Dunn, D-U-N-N.
And how old are you?
I'm 47.
And how long had you been with Miss Rauer?
3.5-4 years.
Did you have a serious relationship with her?
Absolutely. She's my fiance.
Okay. Were you living with her at the time?
Yes, we were.
Was this dog kind of your guy's child?
Yes.
Okay. And what was his name?
His name is Charlie.
Okay. And there was some testimony about, you heard Miss Rauer say, oh, I hate that thug music.
I didn't say this, but if I had said anything, I would have characterized it as rap crap, not thug music. That's not a term I'm familiar with.
His defense attorney questioned him about his seemingly normal life before asking him what happened at the gas station.
Did you ask the guys in the red SUV to turn down that bass?
I did. I said, can you turn that down, please?
What was the response from the red SUV?
They turned it off.
And at that point, what did you then say?
I said, thank you. Very soon after, I start hearing things like F him and F that. And
does it escalate?
Well, the music came back on. Now it got ugly. After hearing the something, something cracker and this and that, I hear, I should kill that motherfucker. Here, I should fucking kill that motherfucker. And now he's screaming.
Okay.
There's no mistake of what he said. That is what he said.
Do you then look over to see, is somebody talking to you?
I put my window back down and I asked, are you talking about me?
Now, what was the response when you said, are you talking about me?
He reached forward and picked something up and slammed it against the door. I didn't know what it was at first, but when he says, yeah, I'm going to fucking kill you, I look and I'm looking at a barrel. He's showing me a gun and he's threatening me.
What happens now?
Well, I didn't react to this. And this young man opened his door, you know, like he cracked it. He just popped it.
What did you believe was about to happen to you?
I thought I was going to be killed, but I still didn't go for my gun at that time. I was just like going, oh, my God, okay. Where is all this hostility coming from? And it was at that point where he said, this shit's going down now.
In your wildest dreams, could you fathom being that position over a common courtesy?
No.
Okay. Now, at this point, what's going through your mind when he said, this shit's going down now?
This was a clear and present danger. And I said, you're not going to kill me, you son of a bitch.
Okay. And as you said that, were you looking at him or were you now moving to that, get that part?
I said that as I was retrieving my pistol.
Could you show the jury exactly what you did?
Well, if we say over here is my glove box, I'm looking out the window, and I said, you're not going to kill me, you son of a bitch, and I shot.
Okay. And do you even recall how many times you shot?
I do not. Kind of was in a fixed position with the tunnel vision. I didn't realize the SUV was moving. I was still aiming at the rear passenger and it didn't register that the car was backing up.
Okay. And at some point you realize now there's no more red door in front of your face.
This is where Rhonda starts coming into my mind because I know she's heard the shots. I know Rhonda. It wasn't just my life I was worried about now.
And at some point now, do you see that SUV actually drive towards a different direction or try to drive away?
It did, and this is where the now they're back in line with if they fire on me, they'll hit the front door, and this is where Rhonda comes out.
What was your purpose of firing towards the back of that vehicle?
Were you I was worried about a blind firing situation where they would, you know, shoot over their heads or whatever and hit me and Rhonda. I stopped firing when it appeared that the threat was over.
Don said that he continued to fire after the teenagers fled from the gas station because he was afraid that he or his fiance may get hit by returning fire. However, there was no returning fire and seemingly there was no shotgun. Don told the courtroom that when Rear got back to the car, he told her that Jordan had threatened him with a weapon.
How was Rhonda once you explained to her what happened? Or did you explain or try to in the vehicle?
I tried to, but she was hysterical.
Okay. And were you still shaking and panicking?
I wasn't much better. And I tried to get out the fact that they were threatening me. I tried to get out the fact that they were advancing on me. I tried to get out the fact that they were armed. I was explaining to her that it was self-defense, but it was difficult, to say the least.
Did you have any belief or inclination that you were going to be accused of murder?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
The only time Don showed any semblance of emotion was when he spoke about his fiancée and his dog. During cross-examination, prosecutor John Guy challenged Dunn. He said that Dunn had parked so close to the SUV that it would have been almost impossible for Jordan to have gotten out. He also suggested that Dunn was furious because he was being disrespected by a young African-American man. Guy asked Dunn if he thought that everybody in the SUV that night was a thug, to which he replied, quote, "The way they acted, yes, I did," end quote.
Mr. Don, you love Ronda Rousey.
Yes, sir, I do.
Right? You love her a lot, right?
Yes, sir, I do.
Right, and when she got into that car, she asked you what happened, right?
Yes, sir.
Sir, are you telling this jury that on the way back to the hotel, you told Ronda Rousey that the boys in the car had a gun?
If I told her on the way to the hotel, I told her several times at the hotel, I told her several times on the way home that this was self-defense.
That wasn't my question. From the time you left the gate station to the time you got back to the Sheraton, how many times did you use the word gun to describe what the boys, let me finish, what the boys in the car had?
I couldn't tell you.
Was it more than one?
At least one.
Mr. Dunn, the truth is, you never told the love of your life that those boys had a gun.
You weren't there.
Did you? You did tell her then?
I said you were not there.
I get that. I know that. Truth is, you never told Ronda Rousey they had a gun.
That is incorrect.
The defense rested its case before the prosecution called Ruhr back to the witness stand to question her further in regards to what Dunn said about the altercation.
When you came out of the gate gas station and you got into the defendant's car?
Yes.
Did the defendant ever tell you he saw a gun in that red SUV?
No.
Did the defendant ever tell you that he saw a weapon of any kind in that SUV?
No.
There was no mention of a stick?
No.
There was no mention of a shotgun?
No.
There was no mention of a barrel?
No.
There was no mention of a lead pipe?
No.
Back in the hotel room, Ms. Rauer, that same night, did the defendant ever tell you that he saw the boys with a firearm?
No.
Did he ever tell you that he saw the boys with a weapon?
No.
On the two-hour drive the following morning, did the defendant ever tell you that he saw a gun in the SUV?
No.
And on that two-hour drive, did he ever tell you he saw a weapon of any kind in that SUV?
No.
Ruhr contradicted Dunn when she said that he never mentioned that the teenagers had a weapon. He didn't mention it when she got into the car. He didn't mention it when they got to the hotel. He didn't mention it when they saw that Jordan had died from his injuries. Afterwards, they too rested their case.
Even if we don't get the verdict that we expect that we should get, at least the truth has been exposed. The fact that she stood her ground and told the truth is huge. And I didn't expect that she would do that. She was the key witness that could testify against him, and she did. I don't know if she has any children. I don't know if she's a mother. But I was praying that if she were, that something in her consciousness, something in her heart, something somewhere would kick in and she would be convicted to tell the truth.
During closing arguments, Assistant State Attorney Erin Wolfson said that Dunn had acted viciously to an argument over loud music and fired multiple shots into a vehicle with a clear lack of concern for human life. After killing Jordan, Don went back to his hotel room, ordered a pizza, had a few drinks, and watched a movie as if nothing had happened. The prosecution told the jury that the evidence clearly showed that Jordan was unarmed and was leaning away from Dunn inside the vehicle, not advancing like Dunn had claimed.
Thugs, he said in his interview. Thugs. You met them. You've met them now. It's your call. Are any of them thugs or gangsters? Jordan Davis didn't have a weapon. He had a big mouth. And that defendant wasn't going to stand for it. This case is not about self-defense. It's about self-denial. He didn't have to shoot him. He decided to shoot him. He chose to shoot him. That's why it's not a self-defense case. That's why it's a murder case, period. I'm going to leave you with one quote. To the living, we owe respect. But to the dead, we owe the truth. Jordan Davis. Jordan Russell Davis. 17. Forever.
During the defense's closing arguments, they maintained that the state had failed to prove that Dunn hadn't acted in self-defense. Defense attorney Corey Strola contended that Dunn had only fired his gun when he saw Jordan with a shotgun.
Michael Dunn must actually believed that the danger was real. That's the standard. That's our law. And whether you like the law or don't like the law, you have to use the law. And that blanket, that flag, wraps around this man until the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not self-defense.
The prosecution rebutted this argument, stating, quote, "That defendant didn't shoot into a car full of kids to save his life. He shot into it to save his pride. Jordan Davis didn't have a weapon. He had a big mouth," end quote.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, again. I understand that we now have a verdict, apparently, as to all counts. I've never seen a case where deliberations have gone on for this length of time, and we must respect the jury's verdict. This is a very, very emotional time. I understand that. I would ask you to continue to abide by my rules of decorum and ask you to please refrain from any emotional outbursts once you hear the verdict read. This case is not about winning or losing. I have the verdict form in count one. There are no markings on it, but I will provide it to the clerk for the record. And based on the jury's inability to reach a verdict as to count one, I would declare that mistried. The other verdict forms are in order. I'll give them to the clerk for publishing.
Verdict is to count two. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of attempted second-degree murder, a lesser-included offense. Verdict is to count three. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of attempted second-degree murder, a lesser-included offense. Verdict is to count four. We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of attempted second-degree murder, a lesser-included offense. We find that the defendant discharged a firearm during the commission of the offense.
After 4 days of deliberation, the jury remained deadlocked on the first-degree murder charge. 10 jurors believed that Dunn was guilty, while 2 believed that he acted in self-defense. Michael Dunn was subsequently found guilty on 3 counts of attempted second-degree murder and 1 count of hurling a deadly missile. A mistrial was declared on the first-degree murder charge. During a press conference afterwards, Florida State Special Prosecutor Angela Corey said that Dunn would be retried on the murder charge. Lucia and Ron told reporters that they would never stop fighting for justice for their son.
We didn't have justice for Jordan. Was he all right to kill my son? I think it's appalling that the stand your ground is in the self-defense. What did the defendant think at the time? And did he reasonably think that he was going to be harmed? That's very confusing. How could they determine as a jury what somebody else is thinking?
We expect the law to be behind us and protect us.
And that's what I wanted the law to do, is protect Jordan as we protected Jordan.
We're so very happy to have just a little bit of closure. And we will continue to stand. And we will continue to wait for justice for Jordan.
Ron reminded reporters that Jordan was a good kid who deserved the law to protect him. Quote, Don is going to learn that he must be remorseful for killing my son, that it was not just another day at the office, end quote, said Ron. While it was acknowledged that with the attempted murder charges, Don would likely spend the rest of his life in prison, the biggest charge, murder or self-defense, was left unresolved. Don not only robbed Jordan of the chance to have a family of his own, but also robbed himself of the chance to grow old in his beach house with his fiancée. The charges were a disturbing reminder that if Jordan was the only person in the SUV that night, then most likely the jury would have let Don walk away a free man.
Prior to this, I never heard a gunshot, barely even seen a gun. All he had to do was basically show us the gun, and I would have been scared just off that.
I thought I just got away, you know, clean. It was a year later near in the trial when I found out my door was literally, like, shot like that. Thank the Lord that I'm still here.
The only reason Don was going to spend the rest of his life in prison was because Jordan was with three of his friends, and that when the spray of bullets hit the car, Jordan was the only one hit. According to Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, the House's assistant Democratic leader, quote, I think it's time for us to stop ignoring the fact that race is a very, very important element in our justice system. For the jury to convict him on a lesser charge and not convict him of murder, when clearly someone was killed, is a travesty of a major proportion. We live in this violent little society where dark skin means we're open prey to any man. It's still okay to kill black people in some parts of America. Not only must we be angry about white people killing us, but when we kill us, end quote. It was decided that Don wouldn't be sentenced for these charges until his retrial, which was slated for September of the same year. In the aftermath of the verdict, Charles Hendricks, a neighbour of Don, told investigators that he wasn't surprised when he learnt that Don had killed somebody. He described Don as a bully who beat and terrorised his ex-wives. On one occasion, Hendricks said Don held a gun to his ex-wife's head and would force them to have sex with strangers. Hendricks recollected how Don's two former wives frequently sought refuge in his home. Quote, They would come to my house, crying, claiming they are scared to death of this individual, said Hendricks in a taped recording with investigators and the lawyer of Jordan's family. Shortly thereafter, a phone call between Don and his fiancée was released.
Hey, sweetie pie.
Hey, honey.
Are you awake?
Yeah, I'm awake. I'm just not feeling well today.
Are you blue?
Yeah.
I was really blue this morning. I finished off a roll of toilet paper blowing my nose.
Yeah.
Because I was crying.
I just hate this so much.
This will be behind us before we know it. So have a good long life together, baby.
I miss you so much.
I just can't shake the notion that I'm like, you know, I'm the rape girl that they're blaming because I was wearing skimpy clothes. Like, I'm the victim that's being blamed. I was attacked, and I refused to be the victim, and now I'm being punished for it. I'm not real optimistic that those boys will tell the truth.
I just want to come home.
Yeah. Yes, I was thinking of that. It's like, what am I gonna do first? I'm gonna make love to my woman, and then I'm gonna sleep. They're like freaking out because a white guy dared to ask them to turn their. I mean, you know, come on. If you ask me to turn down my music, I'm going to kill you. And if you tell me to mind my own business, I mean, Jesus Christ. When, you know, no wonder people are afraid to tell them to pick up their pants.
I don't know, honey.
I'm not racist. They're racist. What is with this subculture that feels entitled to exert their will? The only thing I can think of is the culture. I mean, this MTV culture, the gangster rap. Yeah. And where are their dads?
Yeah.
I don't know what good's going to come out of this, if any good can come out of it, but I'm thinking that somewhere, somehow, we need to make a public statement about the subculture and we need to reckon.
Well, why don't we discuss that at another time?
Alright. It's absurd. Everything is absurd. It's like, I'm the fucking victim here. It's 100% on Jordan. 100%. I don't even take a 0.5%. I mean, he made that happen. But, you know, maybe he would have killed somebody if it hadn't been me.
After 3 days of back and forth in the jury selection process, a jury for the second trial was finalized, and it consisted of 7 white men, 3 white women, 1 African-American man, and 1 African-American woman. The trial followed the same pattern as the first trial, and all of the same witnesses were presented.
The State of Florida versus Michael David Dunn. Verdict: we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of first-degree murder as charged in the indictment.
Mr. Dunn, you having been found guilty of premeditated murder in the first degree of Jordan Davis, which carries a minimum mandatory life sentence without parole, I hereby sentence you to serve that minimum mandatory life sentence without parole.
This time, however, after just 4.5 hours of deliberation, the jury found Michael Dunn guilty of first-degree murder. Jordan's mother and father showed remarkable fortitude and grace with the verdict, expressing sorrow for both Dunn and his family, despite the fact that Dunn never actually apologized for murdering their son. On the 17th of October, Michael Dunn was formally sentenced to life without parole. Following the conviction, Dunn's lawyer filed for an appeal, but it was denied.
Yeah, there's Daddy and Jordan. Bouncy, bouncy, bouncy baby boy. Look at Daddy, bouncy too. Daddy's silly too. They both silly, 1 and 2. These are my sweaty men. This is my handsome husband and my gorgeous little Jordan. Where you going? Hi, Daddy.
When me and Lucy tried to have a child, she had a few miscarriages, and we were, you know, really distraught about that. We thought we'll never have a child together. Like a miracle, you know. It was like she's pregnant, and she just couldn't believe that.
I sing the same.
Her stomach was growing. I saw it growing. Had the C-section. I was right there with the doctor, had my big face right there, and as soon as they brought him out, I was the first face that he saw.
Boy, I tell you what, it looks just like Daddy. Yeah?
It's a fundamental problem where people shoot first and ask questions later. Just like Michael Dunn had the right to carry a concealed weapon, Jordan Davis had the right to blast music in his car how loud as he wanted. Ask yourself this: would Don have acted the same if the group of teenagers were white? And if he did, would it have taken 2 trials for a conviction? Stereotypes can rule our world, and Jordan represented many of the black teenagers that go up against stereotyping and violence. Sadly, black blindness can make people more perceptible to being targeted. And for many young African-American men, the murder of Jordan Davis was a chilling reminder that just by simply existing, your life could be in danger. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Nate Gruz and Casey Chafe. Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support on Patreon really does go a long way in helping the podcast to continue to grow. Thank you. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a positive review or rating on iTunes, or wherever else you listen, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode, I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. We have a podcast promo at the end of this episode for the amazing true crime podcast, Invisible Choir, so please stay tuned for that. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Some of the most heinous murders are the ones you've never even heard of. From Reach Freaks in Himalaya comes Invisible Choir, a new form of investigative true crime storytelling that brings the most depraved and under-investigated crimes to life.
They slammed the kid on the ground and stabbing their baby out here in the middle of...
They're stabbing their baby?
With actual audio from the events, including 911 calls, police interrogations, and confessions.
I shot my wife in the temple of her head. I put her in the freezer. I checked on her at night. I did.
We'll take you on an unforgettable emotional journey to the marginalized communities and crime scenes themselves to bring visibility to the unseen. Download Invisible Choir today on Himalaya or wherever you listen to podcasts.